still playing golf at pro level all this time.
Yeah.
How are you doing that?
I don't know. I was labouring and working with other friends, doing other bits. And that was when I went to the driving range and said, oh, is there any jobs going here? Decided whilst I was there, could I do my PGA here? In my first year, I was doing all the winter series stuff. So you play everywhere in Wiltshire, come number one in that. And I was just really enjoying it. Everything was going along nicely.
And what were the challenges through this time?
The wheels coming off. I would drink and drink and drink and drink. It was Becky getting ill as well and went for a biopsy. I didn't think anything of it. And she said to me, I've got cancer. You didn't sign up for this. I completely understand if like you want to go.
Yeah.
I just said, no chance. Didn't want to go and talk to anyone about it. I lost my license when I was 20 to drink driving. And it just kept getting a bit worse each time. And I never dealt with it, dealt with any of it. Yeah, it was difficult.
Today's episode is one of those conversations that reminds you just how complicated and beautiful life can be. My guest has lived a story of incredible highs and devastating lows. A talented professional golfer who has faced challenges most of us can barely imagine. He's been with his wife since he was just 17. Together they've built a family of four boys and faced everything from life-threatening illnesses to personal battles that nearly cost him everything. After years of struggling with alcohol, pressure and forgiveness, he found his way back. He's now 3 years sober, rebuilding his life, his career and his sense of purpose. This is a story about love, about loss, about resilience and ultimately about redemption. So settle in, take a breath, and join me for this powerful conversation with a man who's learned the hard way that sometimes you have to fall apart before you can truly rebuild. Hey, Ross, so thank you for joining me on today's podcast. Are you excited?
I am excited and nervous. Okay, yeah, very nervous.
That's fine. That's normal. I want to start with your childhood. Let's just get into it really slowly. So what sort of child were you?
I was a very happy child.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a nice upbringing. I grew up in Scotland, so I started my life there. I was born, mum, dad, sister. Moved down south when I was 9. Mm. So for dad's career, we all got up and moved down. I was quite excited about the adventure.
Yeah.
My sister was a little bit more, don't want to leave my friends, don't want to come down. But yeah, then I can remember coming here. Went to Chippenham St. Paul's Primary School.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how it all started off coming down here.
Was it a massive culture shock coming from Scotland to Chippenham?
Speaking different was difficult. Yeah. So in school, when I had a broad Scottish accent.
Yeah, can you imagine?
I had lots of like Mickey take in
and
you want to fit in, you want to get along with everyone. So I had like my clique of friends, but it would always... Yeah, so sometimes you get someone, oh, yeah, he's from Scotland.
And did you leave a lot of family in Scotland? Was it just your mum and dad that came down?
Yeah, all the family.
Oh, wow.
All family in Scotland.
Oh, wow, look at that. So when did you first pick up a golf club?
I first picked up a golf club when I was 10.
Okay.
Hit a few shots with my dad going to the driving range. Wasn't really anything there that was an instant click.
Okay.
I was more into football and everything else. Then I got to about 13.
Yeah.
I was in secondary school and there was all the other lads who were all playing. So that's when it got the competitiveness come out.
They were playing golf?
Playing golf, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That surprises me because having four boys, my boys never played golf. It was all football, rugby, athletics and stuff. So the fact that 13-year-olds are playing golf.
Yeah.
And did you know at that age that you were going to be a standout golfer? Or was it a natural talent or did you have to work at it?
I was quite natural. Yeah. So I didn't really have to work at it much, but it was more the competitive within the lads. So it wasn't something that I thought at the time, oh, okay, I want to really pursue a career in this.
Yeah.
It was, I just want to win.
Just want to beat
them. I want to be, yeah.
So at what stage did you think, actually, I think I could do this all the time? How old were you?
It's probably about 15, 16.
Wow. What happened?
I then got down to about a 3 handicap.
Yeah.
And I started playing for the county. And I loved it then. Really liked it. But I didn't like the clickiness in the golf community.
Tell me about
so that. So when I was playing with other lads there, I was more into... Because I was football and everything was quite laddie. Yeah. And together, and everyone was like, as a team.
Yeah.
When you play golf, it was very individual.
Yeah.
And it was very, if you weren't in those little cliques or niches, it was, it was tough. So even though I wanted to be there, I sort of didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
I preferred to play in the football more, but I loved the golf. So it was like, there was, I had this battle going on all the time.
Like a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So you're 15.
Yeah.
You're playing for the county.
Yeah.
When did you meet Becky, your wife?
I met Becky when I was 17.
Tell me about that.
So it was through some mutual friends. We were out driving around in the cars, as you do.
Yeah.
And I think the first time I'd seen Becky, I seen her at a petrol station. I said to one of my mates, I was like, oh, yeah. I quite like her. And he went, oh, that's Becky. That's Becky. I was like, oh, okay. And I didn't think of it again. And we were out in the cars. I think we were in Focus car park. So it's going back how long it was. And I seen her. I just went over and talked to her. And it was like a instant click for me. I was like, I really like you.
Yeah.
And then we just got to know, meet each other more. And I can remember then for about the next 6 months, we were just, I'd pick her up or she'd pick me up and we'd go out to like 3-4 in the morning, driving around, just finding everything out about each other.
So
inquisitive. What did you do then? What did you do when you were younger? Where did you go to school? Oh, I see. Actually remember seeing you there. And Becky's always got this story. She's like, I remember seeing you when you were 14 rolling down the hill, and just thought, what an idiot. Moncton Park, what is that idiot doing?
Because it's quite rare to meet someone that young and then stay with them.
Yeah.
What do you think it was about you two that you thought, you know what, we'll get married, we'll have kids? What was it? Because you were so young.
We always wanted the same thing.
Okay.
Really early on. So we were always like, we want a family, we want to have children.
Yeah.
We would talk about it from really early on. It was, but things that kept us together more. We went through a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
Early on together, which sort of really bonded us. Yeah.
So how old were you guys when you got married?
I was 20.
And Becky was 22.
Becky was 20.
And me as well. My goodness me. And then how old were you when you had your first child?
No. 19.
19. My goodness me. That. You see, now in this era, that's actually not that young back in the day.
Yeah.
But in this era, that's just, there'll be people watching this going, what, 19? You're a child yourself. But it was kind of accepted. Maybe not in your generation, but definitely in my generation that was accepted.
Yeah.
I want to come on to, I suppose, what you may describe, what I certainly think is one of the most difficult times that you and Becky went through. You know what I'm going to ask you?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Difficult times that we went through.
When Becky found out about...
Yeah, when Becky found out that she had cancer, that was that was difficult.
How old were you guys then? Were you married then?
19. No, we'd been together 6 months.
Talk me through that.
So we'd been together 6 months. I didn't think anything was going on like that. We didn't know. I know that Becky was going for a biopsy for her neck because she had started to like struggle to hear other girls in the salon when they were speaking, and there was other noise going on. And she had these like marbles shaped things in her neck, went for a biopsy. I didn't think anything of it. And I could just remember her coming around my house, sat out in the car, and she said to me, I've got cancer. She was like, you didn't sign up for this. You can go now. God, I didn't think I was going to get all this.
Where's them? Pass me them box of tissues there, please, Billy. Thank you.
Yeah, she just said, you didn't sign up for this. You don't have to like be there, come along for this. I completely understand if like you want to go.
Yeah.
And
that's a lot.
Yeah. I just said, nah. No chance. Absolutely no chance.
So what happened? You're right at the beginning of this incredible journey.
Yeah, right at the beginning. So she started chemotherapy quite quickly. It was every 2 weeks that she would go and have the chemo. Every time she had the chemo for like 2-3 days after, it was bad because it was like the sickness and everything else, and started to lose her hair after a little while. it was difficult. Didn't think I was going to cry.
That's all right.
it was hard.
That must have been so hard.
Mm.
How long was Becky having treatment for? How long did that period go on for?
Becky was having treatment. It was planned in for a year, but you have like scans as you go along. She did 6 months, had a scan, and they thought that it was all completely clear, but they could find just a little P-shaped part next to her heart. They weren't sure if it was gristle or still chemo. So she had to carry on, have another 6 months just to make sure, and then that was it. It was just the year that it went on for.
And then at the end of that year, was she given the all clear, or
End of that year, yeah, she was given the all clear, but she actually had to go for some scans, and that was around the time that they were like, oh, we need to check if you're pregnant and all these sort of things. Yeah. And it was 3 months after her year's treatment. She had the scans, didn't think much of it, and everything was going okay. And then we found out she was pregnant a week after she'd had that scan. So there was another worry that Noah might not have been okay. And even the doctor was saying, look, if the right thing to do is maybe that you don't have this baby, because, you know, it could be deformed, could be things wrong with it.
Oh, so, sorry, I thought all the chemo had finished and then you found out, but it hadn't finished.
It was from the scan, because she'd had the scan.
Oh, I see.
And the scan's really dangerous to have once you're pregnant. That's why they have to check that you're pregnant.
Oh, my goodness.
And we didn't even think that there was a possibility that we weren't be able to have children, because they had said from the start, you know, you...
Because of the chemo.
Because of the chemo. And at the start, I'm pretty sure they couldn't take her eggs either and freeze them, because they normally do that. But they were like, because the cancer's so advanced, we need to get you straight in and just get going with the treatment. Yeah.
So then you guys have another huge decision to make about the baby.
Yeah.
Talk me through that.
Bex comes. Well, we just had that conversation. Bex said to me, "Look, what if he comes out with one arm or anything like that?" I said, "Well, we'd be the best at throwing his other arm." I was like, "It's not happening. This is like a miracle in my eyes. If one minute we're thinking that we couldn't have children, and now she's pregnant," I was like, "No, let's do it."
Was there ever any worry that Becky being so soon after treatment would be, and then being pregnant, would be hard for her body? Was that an additional worry, or
I don't think
she was
so.
No?
Yeah, okay. I don't think that was any more of the worry. It was more because she'd had that scan, and it's like radiation that they just pump all into your body, and or whatever it was. There was levels to it, but they just weren't happy about it at the time. But
Noah's born.
Yeah, Noah's
absolutely born. Fine. He's got 10 fingers, 10 toes. He's all healthy. Yeah. During that time, are you still playing golf? What are you doing? How's that all working out?
Yeah, so I was still playing golf previously, and then it started to wane off a little bit when I'd met Beck, because we were together all the time.
Yeah.
But then once the chemo and the cancer stuff, so I completely stopped.
Oh, did you?
Completely stopped playing golf.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. All sports. Didn't do anything. We just spent all of our time together.
Yeah.
It was just like...
Yeah. So when did you then make the decision, okay, I can go back? Everything's okay. Because now you're about to be a father.
I was labouring and working with other friends, doing other bits. And she wasn't happy. I wasn't happy, like, doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
And Bex could feel that. And she just sat me down one day and she was just like, look, what do you actually want to do? What do you want to do with your life? What you know, gets you going and gets you excited? And I was like, I just really want to go back and play golf. That's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to play golf again or just be around the sport, because I loved it. So I made that decision. There was a local driving range up the road. I went up and I said, look, is there any work going? Could I come in and work here?
Yeah.
And then, so that's what started the golf going again.
So when Becky was ill, you played zero golf?
Zero.
You weren't even going out on a Sunday?
No.
Wow. So how many years did you have off?
That's got to be 3 years.
Wow.
Didn't play at all.
So you're back at the... Driving range?
Driving range, yeah.
Yeah. And talk me through now what happens. Because I don't understand how you go from just picking up the golf club to now being a pro golfer.
Yeah, so it was 20 when I started playing again. I was just going back up the golf club, playing with a few older guys that I used to know. One of my other good friends, Liam, and we'd go out and play together. Had to get a handicap again, so I had to hand in 4 cards. And
so you were a 3. Where are you now when you go back?
Yeah, I went back at a 4.
Okay, that wasn't too bad.
Yeah, because
still
there's
pretty decent.
There was like I can't remember the scores that I shot. It must have been, I don't know, like one under par level. It was still there. I hadn't really gone as much.
Yeah.
And I was just loving it. Loving going out and playing. We'd go play with all the old guys up there, play for some money, do bits and bobs. And,
yeah.
Yeah, and then I was like, right, I really, really like this again. I need to find something to do more in the sport.
Yeah.
And that was when I went to the driving range at 21 and said, oh, is there any jobs going here? Could I come work up at the driving range, just work in the shop?
Yeah.
Got that job. Then decided whilst I was there, oh, could I do my PGA here? And they,
what's PGA?
So your PGA is your Professional Golfers Association. It's okay. Where you can do a degree to teach golf, learn about the business, learn about everything about the game, just the next level, really.
And you have to do that if you're going to be pro?
You don't have to do that.
But you wanted to do that. Okay.
Yeah, so to be a professional, I think it's just 4 or below or 5 or below. Declare yourself as a professional, play in competitions.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go down the route of to have something that I've got as a backup. You know, because I know inside I want to play. I've got this burning feeling I want to play, but I've got Bex at home, got the family at home. I've got to find something that's I can earn more money along the way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then, was Noah born at this stage or no?
Yeah, Noah
was born. He was born. Okay, yeah. And how old are you now?
And Eli, yeah.
Okay.
He was 21 when I had Eli. I had Eli. Becky had Eli.
So you're working, doing the PGA.
Working, doing my PGA. So that takes 3 years.
Oh, wow.
So the plan was whilst I was doing and doing all the, like, the coursework and bits and bobs that you've got to do to get your qualification, I was going to play alongside and work in the shop.
Yeah.
So I just played in all the local PGA stuff. So in my first year, I was doing all the winter series stuff. So you play everywhere in Wiltshire locally.
Okay.
Come number one in that. And then I thought, God, this is great. Like, really enjoying this. And I'd play in all the other PGA stuff, which will go a little bit further afield. And you had the Assistance Championship, so I qualified for that.
Yeah.
In one of the years as well. And I was just really enjoying it. Everything was going along nicely at the start when I was playing. And then it was like, the more I found out about the game, I started to change more about my game. So instead of playing more naturally, I'd be like, oh, well, actually, this should look like that. This should be like this. Because I was learning, actually, technically, that's the right way. But I didn't do it that way. So maybe if I changed that, it would make this better. But it got harder. The more you changed, the harder it got. Okay. So it was away from your natural style.
And that that awkwardness that you had at 15, you know, it's not football, it's golf. Yeah. Is that still there?
Yeah.
Being around the cliques in the golf club and stuff? Yeah. So how are you dealing with that?
You just play a little bit older, so it's not as much there. You're not bothered as much, but it's still there.
Yeah.
It's still like, yeah, but you've got friends within the golf community. So I had other pros that were friends and they were doing the same things or playing, but still ultimately you want to win. So it's just about.
So what does a typical week look like? Because you're working, you're studying, you're playing, you're a dad, you're a husband. Walk me through at that time what an average Monday to Friday looked like. You must have been super busy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'd be gym in the morning, out on the golf course.
Yeah.
Then I'd be at work for 12 o'clock. Now I'd work through till 9 o'clock and then I'd come home. So I wasn't doing as much of the home stuff, but I was doing more of the work out playing golf. When you were doing a competition, if it was further away, I'd be away for a couple of days. And as it progressed, I'd be away for 3-4 days at a time.
Yeah.
And then back and then getting ready to go play again for the next week. So.
And in order to get better because now you're playing it competitively, how many hours are you playing on an average day?
I'm playing every day, trying to play or hit balls every day.
Every single day.
Every single day, yeah.
How did Becky, because Becky's at home now with two little boys.
Yeah.
How did she deal with that? Like, obviously, she supported you through.
Oh, she's absolutely good as gold. She was like, right, no, that's what you focus. That's what you've got to do. You've just got to put everything into it. She's amazing, really.
Yeah.
Amazing woman. Yeah.
So she's like, you're happy now.
Oh, she's like, look, this is what you've got your heart on. Like, I know you want to win. You've got to put everything into it. You've got to go. You've got to push. Yeah, fully support me 100%.
So how far did it go? Talk me through that journey.
So I had my 3 years where I was doing all the PGA stuff. Then I finished that. Then it was on to Euro Pro Tour, which is like the next level up. So you'd go like Euro Pro Challenge Tour onto the main tour. And I only got to the Euro Pro. I played a few other mini tour events like Jamaica Tour, Portugal Pro Golf Tour.
Yeah.
And the idea was eventually I'd try and get into Q School. But
what's Q School?
Q School's another event you'll go to try and get straight to the main tour.
Okay.
So you'd go into that one. It's a little bit more expensive. You can either work your way through the mini tours.
Yeah.
Or go to Q School and get through, which is really difficult.
Okay.
Get through that and onto the main tour.
So ultimately, it was always about the main tour?
Always. Just about winning in general.
And what were the challenges through this time?
The wheels coming off. Just alcohol.
Yeah.
Was a big thing. That was, addiction to alcohol. Just, I couldn't get away from it. I couldn't.
How did that come about? Was that just the social aspect of golf, the 19th hole? How did that all start?
I think it started originally when I was quite young, 15, 16. We used to go out just drinking with the lads as normal. Everything was, they would all get really drunk. And I was always quite controlled. I'd be like, no, I'll have a couple, leave one there. And I was, I'm pretty sure it was late 15, nearly 16. We were going out one night and we were like, oh, my other friend Liam, let's go with your dads before we go out. We'll sit and have a beer. And I can remember being at his front door, looking in the window, thinking, God, why is the dog going around like crazy? And everything's like running around in the house. And we got in the house, went in, and his dad was led down, face down on the floor. I thought, God, he must have had a skin fall. Didn't really think much of it. He's drunk. Went in, turned him over, and he was just blue.
Oh, my goodness.
Completely blue. Panicked, pure panic. Like, right, we need to call the hospital, call the doctors, get something here. Was it the fluids had come out of his body everywhere? He'd been sick, and we were scooping the stuff out of his mouth. And this is my friend, this is his dad. Like trying to like give him CPR, mouth to mouth, everything.
Yeah.
And I can remember waiting for that ambulance was just like the longest 10 minutes of my life. That just felt like forever. And it was after that and whenever I'd had a drink then, I didn't care. I would just,
Join the dots for me. Why after being through that, do you not care? That trauma, what did that do?
I just remember after that, and whenever I had a drink or I'd gone out, that I would just drink. I wouldn't stop drinking. It was more, probably looking back, just trying to escape what was in my head. And like, now we know a lot more about the sort of going to therapy or things that go on your head, trying to talk about it and get it out. But I didn't talk about it. I just, kept it in and just thought, God, imagine if that was me and I'd found my dad, and my dad was like my hero. He's everything to me. And
now you're a dad.
Yeah, now I'm a dad. Time. Yeah. And thinking about him, like my friend as well. Like, and that was it. He's got to live with seeing his dad like that. The last time he ever sees his dad was, it was difficult.
So that pressure, that escapism, how long did that go on for, would you say? And the drinking to sort of mask that?
Probably right up until I was about 30.
Really?
Yeah, because then everything else just kept piling on top.
Yeah.
And I never dealt with it, dealt with any of it.
And you felt a way to cope with it.
Yeah.
So we don't need to deal with it, actually. We can just keep doing this. This is working. But it's not working.
No.
So tell me about, obviously, Becky, how is she dealing with it?
It wasn't really, like, bad at the start. Mm. But it was just, like, I didn't have an off button when I'd drink. I would drink and drink and drink and drink. And everyone just thought, oh, yeah, he's a, heavy drinker, one of the lads sort of thing. But I just couldn't stop once I'd started. It was like,
Keep going.
I feel good. I want to feel better. Yeah. And then, it was Becky getting ill as well when we were 18. And then that one added.
That hadn't been dealt with.
That hadn't been dealt with either. Not really talked that through either. And then had Noah, got married when I was 20, and had another Hila when I was 21. So it just kept building, and the alcohol sort of like it was taking little bits from me. I could feel it. It wasn't me. Like, I lost my license when I was 20 to drink driving. So that was another little bit, stupid mistake of, yeah. And I wouldn't let go of these things. That's the problem, is I would make those mistakes and they would stay with me, and I wouldn't go, oh, that's fine, you made a mistake, carry on. It was like, it would build, and then another one, and then I'd do something else, or have to wake up in the morning and apologize to everyone because I pushed something too far. Yeah. And then that bit stayed with me, and then I'd go back and argue with Becky at the house at night about silly things, and it would build again, and it just kept getting a bit worse each time.
Still playing golf at pro level all this time?
Yeah.
How are you doing that?
I don't know. Yeah, just still practicing, playing, and still believing in my head, but that's always there. All the other pressures are there, and then the drinking would take it away for a minute, and then the next day I'd be practicing playing, or I'd go play in a tournament. I'd be like, in my head, I'd be like, you don't deserve it. You don't deserve it. So I couldn't get out. I couldn't play how I'd...
Yeah. You don't deserve the golf.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it was just deep-rooted. Like, and yeah, I couldn't get away from it. And then I'd be like, oh, I'll just have a drink or something else. And, you know, it's... Yeah, not...
Are family and friends noticing? Is anyone saying anything to you at this point or no?
No, not as much, no.
It's still labelled as social.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's all right to drink, isn't it, on the weekends and Friday, Saturday, maybe on a Sunday, or then you'd have a weekday that you'd have a drink, but it got worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
The older I got.
I think as well, your roots play a part in it. You know, I have a massive Irish family. You have a massive Scottish family. Yeah. They like to have a drink.
They like to
socialise. So there's a part of our family history that almost says to us, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay to, you know, commiserate with a drink, to celebrate with a drink. And I think you can almost get away with it for longer than if it was a drug or self-harming, or do you know what I mean? The alcohol is more kind of socially accepted.
Yeah.
So take me to the time then when you think, that's it, can't do this anymore. It's got to stop.
Yeah, it wasn't so much at me that said that.
Okay.
It was more of a moment of... It came to heads with me and Beck, and she just said that you need to stop. This really needs to stop. And we had a massive, massive argument one night, and she kicked me out of the house and said, well, we're not doing this. I can't keep doing this. When I'd had a battle in the addiction, I wouldn't let things go, and I'd argue back, and I'd be like, no, this isn't right. That's not right. And it was me thinking more about for myself rather than actually what was going on. And yeah, she just had enough.
And by now, have we still got two children, or we got three?
We've got four.
Four.
We've got four.
Four boys.
This was the first big, big moment of when I got kicked out of the house.
And you've been drinking heavy for how long at this time? 10 years?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah.
And are we, what does that look like? Every day? Or just big sessions?
No, it's the big sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, big sessions. Because it wasn't so much like, yeah, I'd wake up and think, oh, I'd have a drink. It'd be in my head. I'd think, oh, yeah, it'd be there. But yeah, it was on the weekends. It was bad. But at home, so everybody had to deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she kicks you out.
Kicks me out.
What happens then?
I went and lived in a mum and dad sort of like outhouse bit. I think I was there for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And the condition was that I would go and get therapy, or I'd go and get help.
Stop drinking,
yeah. But me being me, I'm good at talking. So I talked to Ben, like, no, I'll be fine, you know, everything will be okay. I don't need to do that. Talking my way out of it the whole time. She says that I am the best salesman of myself to her, because I would just talk. I didn't want to go and talk to anyone about it. I just thought, no, I can do this. I can stop. I'm strong enough.
Did you want to stop?
I wanted to.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to stop everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did for a long time. So well, a long time then, which might have been like 6 months.
Without the counselling.
Without the counselling.
Just cold turkey.
Cold
just
turkey,
doing it.
Yeah. Just, I wanted to, really wanted to stop. And it got to a point, I think we were at a wedding or something, and they were coming around with these little limoncello shots, and this was the first time back. And
how long have you been sober at this
6 point?
6 months.
Okay. 6 months, and yeah. Just like out of habit, picked it up, drank it.
Without even thinking.
Without even thinking.
Because you're at a wedding.
Yeah. And just went.
Easy done.
Oh, no. I've had one. I've had a drink in my head, and I wasn't really thinking I wanted another one. So I was like, I've cracked it. In my head, I was like, I've cracked it. I can have one and not have another one. So went over that day. It was fine. Everything was all good. 2 weeks later, I have another drink. But I had two that time. And then the next couple of times, well, I've cracked it. Next week, and I have 3, 4. And it'd be the next week, and then it just gradually worked its way back in. Wasn't really saying anything. It would just be sneaky ones, lying, not saying that I wasn't. And then that came to a head again of more of the fact of, I just admitted, I come and said to Beck one night, I was like, look, I've still been drinking. I'm sorry, like, just felt like a failure, felt like, but I needed to say to her that, this is what had happened. And yeah, that was the time that it really, really fell apart.
So she had no idea from the wedding up until this point?
Oh, she knew little bits, but not as much as what it was.
Mm. And you said to me, that's when it really fell apart. Talk to me about that.
Oh, she just said, that's it. Like, you said you weren't going to do it. Like, you've got to go. I've had enough. That is it now. Yeah. You're not coming back in the house. You're going to have to move out to your parents. Like, she was like, you said that you were going to do it, and that is it. And that was, yeah, that was when I really, like, broke down inside. That was a hard, hard bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I genuinely thought, like, hand on heart, even still now, I thought I'd lost my family.
And are we still playing golf or no? At this point?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No, I wasn't playing golf then.
So here you are, no golf.
Yeah.
No Becky. No kids. How old are you now?
35.
What do you do?
Cash for this.
Come on. But no, before we get onto that, how do you convince Becky? What do you actually do to convince her, okay, I'm turning this whole thing around?
I said I'd go to therapy. Okay. I said that... There was lots of other conversations, but it was like, look, I will go get help. Like, I'll show you that I can change. I really will show you. And this went on for 3 months. That was back at my parents. And yeah, I did go to therapy.
Yeah.
And I can remember being at that first therapy session and driving to it and going, oh, I'm just going to go here, have a chat with this lady. Like, give her the little brief run over, just the little bits. I'm not going to let her know too much. And looking back, I don't even know why I was thinking like that, but that's just what was going on in my head. And I walked in, sat down, just started talking to her, having like a normal conversation. She, a little bit like this, actually, she went back, asked me about all my childhood and everything that had gone on and all these other key moments in my life. And then she said to me, what do you think about forgiveness? And I just sat there and looked at her for a minute. And then I just completely broke down, a little bit like I did earlier with the tears. It just all came out. I said, I'll never forgive myself. No matter what you say, I'm never going to forgive myself. Because I've, look what I've done. Like, my wife doesn't want to be with me. Like, I'm nearly lost to my family. I can't make myself better. I'm just a failure. I can't do my golf. I can't, everything I do. Yeah.
Wow.
Still hurts now.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Does it really?
Oh, it really hurts, yeah.
What hurts more?
The fact that I did that. The fact that I was that person, and I really don't feel like that person. It's almost like I'm making it up, or I'm lying, so I don't.
Yeah.
But I know I did. I know I made all those mistakes. And
is it fair to say that because you are so competitive, that that's probably why you don't let yourself off the hook?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it get easier? as more time goes by?
It does. It does get easier. You still get moments. I mean, like, I was only in Germany last week and someone came up with little rum shots at the end, like a, you know, a nice thing. It's all made and they put them on the table. And like, in my brain, it's going, oh, you got to be, you know, it's just polite. You should drink that. But then I said, no, I don't love that. So you still have little moments,
but
I can say no. I can, because I know what it costs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want my family, I want everything else more than drinking or anything like that.
So sober 3 years.
Sober 3 years.
You finished the counselling. Becky takes you back.
Yeah.
So now we're on the up again. Talk to me about Cash for Clubs. What is Cash for Clubs for those that are watching and don't know?
So Cash for Clubs, we buy, sell and part exchange golf clubs.
Yeah.
Mainly secondhand.
Yeah.
So you can come in and if you're fresh to the game and just start in, we'll piece together some clubs for you.
Yeah.
And get you on that journey along the way. Make it more affordable for people.
How did all that start?
So I actually started with my other business partner, Neil, came to me with another business idea.
Yeah.
Which was redesigning golf clubs or stamping your initials and doing things like that. And he'd seen this other company and he said, Ross, do you think we could do something like this? Or this business was actually up for sale. And I was like, yeah, we could do something like that. That would be quite cool. So we kept having conversations back and forth about how we could do it. And it was this specific machine we wanted to buy at the time. And we're like, okay, how could we raise some funds to get this machine?
Yeah.
And I was like, it was COVID at the moment, or just coming into COVID. I was like, I'll buy and sell golf clubs at the same time and just see where it goes. And then that first week, bought all these clubs, sold them all. And I was like, that was easy, you know, like, because I had such knowledge of the game and I'm passionate and I want to help. So people just ring me and I give them advice. I'm like, no, stick with what you've got. Just change the settings on it like this or do this. Yeah. Wasn't even trying to sell it to them. They would go and tell a few other people, oh, go and ask Ross. He'll give you a bit of hand with that.
Yeah.
And it just sort of naturally progressed from there. It wasn't like this business idea we had originally. It just
organically
went along the way. Yeah.
And how long have you been doing that now?
I've been doing Cash for Clubs for 4 years.
And how big has the business got?
It's quite big.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a national business.
Yeah.
So yeah, our social media's really helped us. That's what's grown the business into what it is today. But yes. Good.
And how many employees have we got?
We've got 7 employees.
Wow. Yeah. And what's the plans for Cash for Clubs?
The plans for Cash Clubs, we're actually just about to move into a bigger unit.
Bigger unit.
A bigger unit, yeah. So we just want to expand. And as my competitive nature, I want to be the biggest secondhand golf business in the UK.
Who is currently the biggest?
There's two. So you've got Golf Clubs for Cash and Golf Bidder.
Okay.
They're the two big boys.
So you're biting at their heels.
Yeah.
How far behind them are you? Are you close? We're closing that gap?
I think there is... On the trajectory we're going, we should catch them up. I reckon 5 years, 6 years, but they're big. They're big.
Because there was a story, I don't know if you were telling me or one of my boys were telling me, didn't somebody come overseas to see you? One of your videos, actually, this guy came into the shop and he'd come all the way from where?
Germany. So we've had Germany, Turkey, Thailand, Egypt.
That's incredible.
I still have to pinch myself sometimes. When they come in, I think it's like, you're winding me up here. I think they're having a joke. But
And you are you posting golf clubs out? Are you sending stuff out to be delivered?
Yeah, we send some up, but it's mainly UK.
I was going to say, you don't do overseas.
We have done. We've sent like a set of Muras to China. We've sent something to Australia, which was a driver. So we have sent the bits, but... It's not as cost effective because the postage is really expensive.
Yeah. So the journey, my God, Ross, that's a mad journey. What have you learned, do you think, from that journey?
Self-discipline is a massive key thing for me. Mm. So just waking up in the morning, making sure that I get in my ice bath or do something like that straight away. Yeah. To be honest with people around you, to talk. Don't hold everything in. Don't bottle it up and not express what's actually going on inside, especially to the ones that are really close to you.
Yeah.
That's the ones that you end up not speaking to, but you'll speak to other friends that you think it's, but it's actually the ones that really coached you, to be honest with.
Do you think, because having listened to your story, I just think your four boys are super lucky because you've been there, you've done it, you get it. You know what I mean? If they're having hard times in the future, it's like, Dad's so going to get this. Do they have that confidence to be able to share that with you?
Yeah. We're all quite open I hope we are, and have conversations. And we always have a family meeting on a Sunday. But that brings you back. That was another really difficult moment because we sat them all down and told them when I was leaving the house that I was going to get help. I needed to get help. So it was it's a strange feeling being vulnerable or feeling like you're failing and actually telling your children. And that was really, really difficult.
That must have been so
really
hard.
Difficult, especially when they look up to you and they think, oh, this is, this is Dad. And yeah, well, that's nearly got me going again, that one. Sorry, Jason.
That's all right.
But yeah, that was, I can just remember them speaking and going, oh, are you and Mum splitting up? What's going on? You're breaking up? And it was like, no, I just need to get help for myself to make myself better. So it can be better for you guys. And
how did they deal with that?
Okay, I think at the time it's always hard to know, isn't it? You don't really know like what's going on or what that's done for them and inside them and in their head.
How old are they all now when we're having this conversation? So,
Noah's just coming up 16, Eli's 13, Rocco's 10, and Stoic's 6.
So they would have been, all this happened 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So 13, the eldest, and 3, the youngest.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. And the fact that you went for 3 months then. Yeah. Did you visit?
I was back every day.
Yeah.
Every day. So like my mum and dad lived half an hour away. So I'd get up at 4, drive home, get the dogs, go walk the dogs for an hour, then come back, then help to school, then do all that. And then every evening, me and Becky would sit and talk. So we would try and talk everything through and go through, what about this? What happened then? What happened then? And, just try and communicate, keep the communication going. So I wanted to keep talking. So I was so nervous that,
you'd lost it all.
Becky was just numb. It was hard. I hadn't had that feeling, but she was just like, I could feel it. I was like, this is over. That's just how I felt at the time. Yeah. But we'd be talking to like 11, 12 o'clock at night, and then I'd drive back to my mum's, sleep for 3 hours, up at 4, back again, just constantly on that grind. Looking back now, feeling back, it just felt like I was, from that moment, building myself every day, like one brick at a time. Right, you've got to do this, all the little things, get in the ice bath, walk the dogs for an hour, do the things with the kids, be the family man more, and just keep the wheels moving.
And is it still like that? Is it still one day at a time, just focus on today? Or do we have a bigger picture now?
Yeah, bigger picture. Yeah. It's not as much one day at a time. It's more everything's business. Well, me and Bex work closely together, so we're with each other every day. And everything's about the kids. So we just want to be successful for the kids. That competition's still there because it's good with the social media because you can see what everybody else is doing, see what you're doing. So that keeps like a little fire going inside. Oh, we've got to be more than them, got to be bigger than them.
Yeah.
And with business. So, but we do it together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the pressure, which you didn't have a coping mechanism before, how do you deal with that now?
There is no pressure. I don't feel like there's pressure.
Really?
Yeah. We've just got each other, and everything happens for a reason. I've gone like a little more faithful and spiritual as the years have got older, and we just take day by day. We've got a plan. Everything's got a plan that we're doing in the clubs, but we don't really get stressed. Like a lot of friends that we know, other people that get stressed with things that we're like, that's just not stressful. I don't know, but it is to them, but it's not. I don't know, when you've gone through a few things like that together, we don't really get as stressed.
And do you think sobriety has helped that? Because
100%.
I think drinking in itself can bring it on its own pressure. So if we take that out of the equation.
Yeah, it's the best thing I've done in my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Give me two reasons why.
I've still got my family.
Yeah.
and I feel good about myself. I feel like I'm free in myself. I don't feel like I need something to relax. I don't need something to feel better or empty my head. I'll just deal with that.
Yeah.
I don't need anything else. It's just me.
And how's the forgiveness going? We're getting better at that.
Yeah, I'm getting better at that. Yeah. Meditation.
Really?
Ice bath. Do every day. So I'm in the ice bath every day. Me and Bex meditate at night. So
nice.
Yeah.
For those that are watching this and struggling, don't know which way to turn, it's all gone rock bottom, all gone south. What would you say? What would you say to them?
No matter how bad it gets, it can get better. Like, no matter how much you think you can't stop, or you're so addicted that you can't get this thing out of the head, you can. You just need to communicate. You need to talk to people and be honest.
Do you think the talking, the communication, the honesty, do you think that then, because there'll be a lot of people saying, I just don't have the discipline. I don't have that self-will to be able to stop. I try and I just can't do it. Do you think the communication, the honesty helps with that?
Yeah. I do think it helps. And you can have other little tools or things that you can do. Like, for me, it's getting up early in the morning and going into an ice bath, doing something difficult.
Purpose.
Makes me feel like I'm winning. So it makes me feel that I'm straight away into that positive mindset. I'm like, God, that feels good. I feel good. And then I've done something hard, and then it just sort of carries on throughout the day.
Yeah.
I know when I haven't done it, because I'm like, oh, I don't quite feel right for the day.
Going
to the gym's another one that we do. So just making sure it's the self-care things that really help. The little disciplines. It's not the big things. You always think, oh, it's the big things. I really need to stop doing this, stop doing that. But it's the little things, like making your bed in the morning. It's those tiny little bits that make the bigger picture that much better.
Yeah. Do you think you'll go back to golf?
Potentially.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think I will when I've got more time.
Yeah.
The main focus now is...
The business,
family, making sure everyone's settled. Because it does take a lot of time. And it's not something that I'd want to take lighthearted. If I wanted to do it, I'd want to do it properly.
And you're back in that whole environment again.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'd be different.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be nice. I wouldn't feel as much of the pressures because I've got everything else as there. I would just be, it'd be back like when I first started playing. It'd be playing for fun and just wanting to win.
Yeah.
And, you know.
When you were 15.
Yeah. Mm. Not having those family pressures or thinking everything else. It would just be me on that golf course. Or maybe Becky caddying for me. That'd be quite cool.
Final question from me. What does happiness look like now for Ross? Yeah.
Like this.
Perfect answer.
Yeah, honestly, I'm like, happiness is just the little things. It's going home and the kids just being like, oh, hi, Dad, or not having anything else in my head that I feel like I'm doing wrong or hiding or inside. It's the little bits of lying, the little bits of deceit that just eat away at you. It's getting rid of that, and then you just,
Oh, thanks, Russ.